Okay, go ahead.
Asking why it is important to break a kadashi on a certain time. Why it is so important?
The technicality is related to the nature of a vow or a vrata. So you're taking a vow to follow Ekadasi for the day of Ekadasi. That means that when the Ekadasi is finished, when the day is finished, you have to break the fast. And then there's a certain period, a sandhya, in which the suitable time for breaking is there, before it's really considered that you are ready into the next day. So that's why that period is given. If you're just like, you know, why are you fasting from grains? Because that's the nature of the vow. So the vow also includes a length of time. Therefore, when that time is finished, that's when our Ekadasi times are given to break Ekadasi. Just like tomorrow is going to be Ekadasi. And the next day there will be a 3-hour period for breaking fast. So that time period, Titi, that goes according to different astrological calculations. I say the Titi goes according to a certain astrological calculation, and it's established as the juncture of time meant to break a fast at the end of the fasting period and before the next day.
Question, when does the Ekadasi start? Does it start at 12 o'clock in the midnight of that day, or does it start in the morning during Mangalarati?
My understanding is that it can start at either time. It depends on the vow that you're taking, but then you have to stick to it. Time-wise, the day is one's finished and one starts, or at least at midnight. But from the spiritual point of view, Mangalarti is equally good or better. Generally, the way we observe Ekadasi is that when we go to sleep, that's the last time that we eat grains, and then we get up before Mangalarti and go through the whole next day and so on. And then?
Another question from Krishna Priya. Uh-huh. When we were speaking about different shlokas of our acharyas, she is asking that maybe you can recommend some shlokas that we can remember when we have some difficulties in spiritual life, and vice versa. Which shlokas can we cite when we feel very joyful and happy?
Maybe you can ask Haridev to select verses in that regard. Yeah, he will. If she wants to know, then she can ask him, and he can recommend different verses. In other words, I've already got enough things to do to keep me busy 64 hours a day. But you know, I did. When was that? Last March, I did podcasts with prayers that are in Navabraja Mahima. That's long. That's like about, I don't know, maybe it's 100 prayers. Okay, and what else?
We have more questions.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
Next question is from Natalia, and she says that she doesn't have opportunity to offer prasadam to her husband, and she is offering a prasadam to him through his photograph. Is that correct?
But how does he stay alive if he just eats through a photograph? Doesn't he eat? I guess he must be spirit advanced. Anyway, it doesn't really quite replace offering, getting him to actually eat prasadam. Why doesn't she eat with her husband? She doesn't live with him. I don't think it's a practice that he should do. It won't. It's not a recommended thing. That is, send him some sweets or something like that. Actually, get him to eat the real thing. And then,
okay. Concerns organs and tissue donations. And lately, it became very popular, you know, to donate organs and tissues to other people. And I wonder how this practice refers, how it corresponds to Vedic, understanding. Because it could be that our tissues and organs, they contain some karma which we pass to other people. So do we recommend actually for devotees to do such things?
Well, there are examples of organs or even body. This Dadachi Muni, he gave his bones to make the Vajra of Indra. There are examples of transplanting, just like Daksha got the head of a goat, Ganesh got the head of an elephant. Ganesh got the head of an elephant. The real question is not so much the karma. The real question is who is going to benefit from a organ transplant. If it's going to be a person who is not using his life for elevation but for degradation, then that becomes a not a good thing. That's karmic. But if one is donating one's organ for the benefit of some other Vaishnava to perfect their life, then that's valuable. On the other hand, generally doing things like that is probably not something that's an activity in the mode of goodness. But then if someone else's life can be saved by it, then and it's that of a Vaishnava, then it may be something a devotee wants to do. I think it will be an individual choice, and that's what's the real bottom line here, is the devotees have to decide for themselves. No one should tell them what to do. Ultimately, when you leave this body, and if you leave this body in good consciousness, you're going to Krishna. So whether it becomes food for worms or it becomes burnt, may as well put it to some valuable use. Something else about that?
You can explain to us what is the balance between the attitude towards what we are doing and the eagerness to achieve the result of the activity.
The attitude and the eagerness to achieve the result. Isn't the eagerness to achieve the result part of attitude? Well, anyway, I understand. You mean the motivation for getting a result? Is that what you mean?
On one hand, we are supposed to be acting as the servant of the servant with a particular attitude. But at the same time, we have to achieve a certain particular and measurable results. So when we are trying to act in our life, in our devotional service, it seems like we are facing this so-called contradiction that, it seems difficult to balance these two things for us, for some devotees.
Well, the general motivation of pure devotion is to please Krishna. And pleasing Krishna means to please Krishna's representatives. And at the same time, if we're trying to achieve a result for Krishna's pleasure and for the pleasure of Krishna's representatives, then the mood or the motivation remains consistent. Is that... Does that answer your question, or you want to clarify any further? In other words, in both cases, the motivation is the same. It's to please Krishna. I'm following have an attitude of trying to serve my predecessors to please them, and I also have the attitude of getting a result to please Krishna. So that that makes the common denominator between the two, and that sort of bridges that gap. It's not a contradiction, but rather it remains consistent. Okay.
Asking about faith in ISKCON and faith in Srila Prabhupada. Is that some special sort of faith, or is just the, you know, it's just the faith which we should, you know, I don't know how to interpret. So he's asking, is this some special sort of faith? And he is asking why some devotees remain faithful to ISKCON and to Srila Prabhupada and are proud to be a part of ISKCON, and while other devotees go away to Gaudiya Math and to some other societies and they don't remain faithful.
I mean, like, respectful towards Srila Prabhupada personally.
Well, I think it should be clear to any devotee who knows Prabhupada that Prabhupada wanted devotees to work together in ISKCON. Whatever problems beset ISKCON beset other Vaishnava organizations. And a follower is judged by the fact that he follows. He follows the order of the founder Acharya. So Prabhupada wanted devotees to resolve ISKCON's problems within ISKCON, not run away from them. Having full faith in Prabhupada, devotees do that. And maybe even the word faith isn't the right thing, but rather being fully obedient. Then other devotees may go to other spiritual organizations and they may try to get away from those problems. But then they're not being fully obedient to what Prabhupada said. That doesn't make them completely disobedient, or it doesn't make them completely antagonistic, put it this way, to Srila Prabhupada, but it means that they didn't completely follow Prabhupada's instruction. So they may be obedient, but they're not so obedient. They may be faithful, but they're not so faithful. And they may continue to chant Hare Krishna and practice devotional life. That's wanted for everyone to do. But in their life, they will always have to find some kind of excuse to justify why they think that it was all right not to follow Prabhupada's instruction to leave ISKCON. Not to leave ISKCON, I mean. Hare Krishna. Anything further on that?
She is asking a question. Devotees who came back from the seminar in New Vrajadama with great inspiration told us about what they saw. Some devotees said that they became sure that this miracle is possible everywhere, but I am very doubtful about this. I think that the key factor in such projects is the presence of the Vaishnava who can accept all responsibility for the mission and for the devotees and for all that happens. And not everyone is capable of that. What is your understanding of this?
It has to be replicable because, you know, it wasn't done with any kind of supermen or super Vaishnavas. It was just done with regular devotees. And the whole idea is that this is what should take place, not only just in ISKCON, but actually this is what should take place all over the world, even in the non-ISKCON world, in the Karmi world. People should learn how to live naturally off the land, putting God in the center. But it requires a very clear mandate. It requires a clear vision of what's happening, and devotees have to be willing to sacrifice in order to make such a project work, which means that they're willing to sacrifice for Krishna. And Srila Prabhupada wanted that, you know, his followers take responsibility for this. If we're preaching to people to come to Krishna consciousness, then we also need to show them how to live in Krishna consciousness. And everyone needs to be able to have the opportunity to live in Krishna consciousness. Of course, I don't think New Vrindavan is the only project that works in this way. But there should be many, many, many such projects in order to facilitate the many devotees. When we had our self-sufficiency or sustainability conference, the last presentation was about a certain topic. And that subject was to show with accounting data that living in New Vrindavan, people live on a higher standard of living than they do in Hungary, and actually on the same level as they do in the EU. In other words, it's not just an issue of faith or real austere lifestyle to live as we do in New Vrindavan. Devotees who live here, they have a higher per capita income than the average Hungarian. Of course, we don't pay them, but in terms of the benefits that they enjoy, it's more than, it's on par with the average European, like German, French. There is zero unemployment in Hungary, in New Vrindavan, I mean. There's no inflation. So, often, you know, devotees don't have faith that actually you can live better, and this is a better life than the life that they're living anywhere in any city. So then the question is, why doesn't everyone live like this? And there are different answers, but basically is they're not willing to make the sacrifice what it takes to live like this. It's like Srila Prabhupada gives the example that you find a drunk on the street who's living outside on the street in the cold, and you tell him, just give up your alcohol and you can come and move in and live in a nice warm temple. But will they do it? Generally not. Similarly, devotees can establish such communities and they will live better than they're living by toiling in cities. The question is, are you willing to give up some of your comforts of life or discomforts of life? So it's... I was very happy when I heard that whole presentation, because it irrefutably proved that what Prabhupada said was correct. This is the opulent lifestyle. Hare Krishna. So, any other news about on any devotees?
So, from Karuna Mai.
Uh-huh.
And actually, it was from the last conference already, but I didn't have time to tell you. She says that she and Dennis are better, and they feel much better, and that Karuna Mai, she started her service in the temple again.
Uh-huh.
And she has some question also, if I can read it.
Uh-huh.
That lately he has so many things to do, because he has to go to the hospital and there are some family affairs and so on, and these all things require so much attention, and his consciousness is absorbed in all these things, and it is difficult for him to completely concentrate on his chanting and read books and listen to the lectures. And what to do, to wait until he, you know, until he settles all these things, because he cannot fight with this. Thank you. This is his question.
I'm going to translate. Well, that's what the material world is all about. There's so many distractions. There's so many other things to do. And so they should be done. And so he should do them. And at the same time, try and do his best to be absorbed in his spiritual practices. Everyone has... everyone who, especially who's a grihastha, they have so many obligations to take care of. And then even brahmacharis and sannyasis, they've got also so many other duties to do. So as long as you're in this world, you're always going to have to live in a state of balance. So somehow or another, we need to be able to get this balance and then maintain it. Five more minutes. I need to go over and see the deities, because I just right in the morning, then I'm taking lunch, and I'm coming back, and then I'm doing things, then I see the deities, then I'm writing in the evening. And any news on Shuddha Bhakti Chintamani?
We are finishing with the editing of the book. This is the last edition which we are doing now, and after that we will start publishing the book, and I think after the new year it will be published.
Okay, sounds good. Let's see when we'll have the next meeting. Well, it could be next week this time for me. Wednesday. Is that okay for everyone? Okay, so let's have it next week at this time, and then we can continue.